4, Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. China has fired back in a spiraling trade dispute with U.S. President Donald Trump by raising import duties on $34 billion worth of American goods. AP correspondent Ben Thomas has that story.
The list includes 545 U.S. products, including soybeans, electric cars, and whiskey. China's Commerce Ministry says it's responding on an equal scale to the U.S. tariff hike announced Friday. Analyst Erland Eck says Washington's go-it-alone approach undercuts its leverage.
If the EU, Japan, and some other countries were to team up with the U.S., in a more sophisticated strategy, then I think they will be more alarmed.
China says it's also scrapping agreements to narrow Beijing's multi-billion dollar trade surplus with the U.S. Ben Thomas, Washington.
U.S. President Donald Trump renewed his defense Sunday of the agreement he reached with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula, saying it already has led to an end to Pyongyang's nuclear test and rockets not flying all over the place. Trump has voiced irritation at a U.S. critics' assessment that the brief pact he and Kim signed at their Singapore summit was not specific enough to ensure an end to North Korea's nuclear weapons development. Nigerian authorities say that suicide bombings have killed at least 31 people in northeastern Nigerian state of Borno. Those blasts occurred on Sunday. Now, there was no immediate claim or responsibility for these attacks, but the attack did bear the hallmarks of radical militant group Boko Haram. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani announced that despite the suicide bombing killing at least 26, the Afghan government ceasefire with the Taliban has been extended. The government ceasefire was due to end Tuesday. Ghani's comments came on the second day of the Muslim holiday that caps the fasting month of Ramadan. Meanwhile, survivors describe what took place.
The Taliban and Afghan security forces were in their vehicles in the area. There was a crowd of people, heard a blast, and saw children and dead bodies around.
The ceasefire has been marked by incredible scenes of Taliban fighters embracing and even praying with security forces. Politicians and civilians across the war-battered country in a massed outpouring of emotion over the first nationwide ceasefire in the area since the 2001 U.S. invasion. Saturday's attack on a crowd celebrating the ceasefire in the eastern province of Nangarhar was the first major incident of violence since the ceasefire started. Eight people and two separate incidents were killed Saturday in Nicaragua's capital, Managua. Early Saturday, masked men threw Molotov cocktails into a house, killing four adults and two children, all members of the same family. In a separate incident, the National Police said that municipal workers, police, and local residents came under attack while removing barricades and other obstacles from an avenue in Managua. Masked men shot and then set on fire two people, helping to clear the road. The minister there said that Nicaragua has experienced an unprecedented savagery, a wave of crimes that dismays the fight. The arrival of rescue ships into the Spanish port city of Valencia has reignited a battle in Europe over migrant reform. Reuters' David Doyle reports.
Hundreds of migrants pulled from the Mediterranean by a rescue ship arrived at the Spanish port of Valencia on Sunday, bringing a grueling 9-day voyage after they were turned away from Italy and Malta to an end. But what has not ended, indeed has been reignited, is a fierce debate over how Europe handles immigration.
Immigrati.
Barring the rescue ship Aquarius was a chance for Italy's new government to assert its anti-immigrant credentials, while for new Spanish Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez, it was an opportunity to underline a more liberal stance. But what it's also highlighted is the European Union's failure as a whole to agree on how to manage huge numbers of people fleeing poverty and conflict.
That's Reuters' David Doyle reporting. And I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
If you were to take a real count of what Cameroonians are saying in the country, you find out that a majority of Cameroonians do not subscribe to all the gymnastics which he is doing.
Cameroonian opposition parties reject calls by President Paul Biya to postpone the October elections.
So because you are a president that you can kill people or, you know, send people to jail without, you know, them being condemned.
DRC President Joseph Kabila calls for a new law to protect former heads of state from prosecution.
Some say that it's still too early to judge him, so they want to give him some time. But the issue of asset declaration, if the constitutional issue has a time frame attached to it, there are other laws supporting it, and then it is being blatantly ignored.
And the Liberian Internal Affairs Minister calls for the reinstatement of Bong County chiefs. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Cameroonian opposition groups say calls by President Paul Biya to delay this year's elections for a year is regrettable. They say the postponement call is an admission that the government has failed to carry out its core mandate to protect life and property of Cameroonians. The remarks came after President Paul Biya called on the Senate to postpone the upcoming October general election for a year. This as the country faces the ongoing conflict in the English-speaking regions. For reaction, I read Joseph Banerjee, minority leader in the Cameroonian parliament from the opposition Social Democratic Front, or SDF.
My reactions are a bit mixed. First of all, we are aspiring to govern, and the situation in the country is so rotten that any normal elections at this moment will make inroads and permit us to have a better say in the governance of the country. But over the year, I think we have talked a number of times, and I have insisted on the fact that the laws are bad. Before we go in for any elections, we want laws to be straightened. If by extending the mandate by 1 year, he's telling us that we will look at those laws, straighten them, and then go out for elections when everybody will be sure of what you have, when you have what you deserve. Then we will say that, okay, we go with that. But this is a man who has never done something good since he took over power 37 years ago. So this might be another ploy to gain time, because all they want to do is gain time.
Does this mean that the government is admitting that the crisis in the English-speaking regions are a challenge? Because I understand only about 3% of the 20% population of the English-speaking Cameroonians have registered to vote.
I wanted to also come to that to say that implicitly he is using the Anglophone crisis as a cover so that he can gain time like they always normally do. So there are a number of factors, and I think that one could also be a major factor, because you will not have elections when one part of the country is not taking part.
Some are suggesting that since you have over 70% of the population who are Francophone and they like the president and what he is doing, it's unlikely for President Paul Biya to be defeated in an election in Cameroon. Do you subscribe to such suggestions?
No, I think we choose a candidate who is very likable by all Cameroonians, not only Anglophones. Our candidate can sell in any part of Cameroon, and that's why we love to go to elections immediately when the steam is there.
If the president is suggesting that the entire election should be postponed for at least a year, I understand the constitution only allows for only senatorial and parliamentary elections to be postponed, but the presidential cannot be postponed. How do you reconcile these inconsistencies, if I may ask?
Well, the constitution is saying one thing, and the constitution does not permit the presidential elections to be extended. But you know them. If they had a reason, if they found any good reason to postpone it, they will amend the constitution. So they have never worked on anything as the constitution says.
So looking at the majority of the ruling coalition in both parliament and the Senate, what recourse has the opposition to challenge this, and how do you address this head on?
It's difficult for us to make our way heard. The thing is that he's exhausting himself in all this gymnastics, and they are coming to an end, because you realize, you take note that if you were to take a real count of what Cameroonians are saying in the country, you find out that a majority of Cameroonians do not subscribe to all the gymnastics which he is doing.
So what is the next step for the opposition in this political confrontation with the ruling coalition?
Since he has not asked to postpone, to extend the presidential elections, we will meet him in September on the presidential elections, because the fight starts from there. We are bent on, using the disappointment, the disarray in the country to push him out from the presidential elections, and then to rectify things and put this country right from the presidential management.
Joseph Banajem is the minority leader in the Cameroonian parliament. He spoke with me from the capital, Yaoundé. Opposition groups in the Democratic Republic of Congo have rejected as a distraction President Joseph Kabila's suggestion that Parliament considers a new law to protect former heads of state from prosecution. Supporters of the president say his call is a strong indication that he will not contravene the constitution by running in the December polls. But the opposition groups say the president's suggestion seeks to lessen international and local pressure on him not to seek additional terms in office. For reaction, I reach Abraham Luakabwanga, National Secretary in charge of communication for the main opposition Union for Democracy and Social Progress, or UDPS, and spokesperson for the party's leader, Felix Tshisekedi.
First of all, I must say this is another try from President Kabila to distract people to the main point or the main reality. I think the day when Kabila will step in and show you publicly and officially that he will not seek for third terms and he won't be president of the Congo and he will respect the constitution, I think that day a lot of crowd upon the Congo will be dismissed. Actually, Kabila is the one who's been playing around, because he doesn't, we all as opposition people know that he doesn't want to leave the power. So calling those, the parliament to think about the law, this should not be from him. This also is showing the fact that Kabila is controlling everything. It should be Mr. Obani Nyako and the people from the parliament to say, okay, let's talk about this. He's not the one who is going to call at one point and say, okay, this is important for me to think about how protecting the president. Why that? Because Jean-Pierre Bemba is being released?
Some are suggesting in Congo that this call by President Kabila is a sign that he's willing to go, so that when he leaves, people will not come after him to prosecute him for things that happened while he was president, and that the opposition should welcome this. Why are you not even accepting or thinking along those lines?
Even friends. Okay, President Sarkozy, Lula in Brazil, actually they're facing trial. Why? Because they misunderstood the way they were president. So it is the same. We cannot, an open door to somebody. If we found out that Kabila has killed people, has murdered, he's been involved into mass massacres, should we say, okay, we're going to kill everything? And no, I think Kabila is actually protected by the Constitution, by being a senator for life. But if during his candidacy, we did some bad things, I think, such as every single person, because we all under the law, yes, to face the law.
The opposition has been calling on him not to violate the constitution to stay in power for additional terms or seek a third term in power. Don't you think that it would be wise, as some Congolese are suggesting, that an incentive should be given to him to allow the legal process to continue so that for the first time, the Democratic Republic of Congo would have one elected president handing over in a smooth transition to another legitimately elected president, and that this is part of the process to encourage him to leave power? Wouldn't the opposition consider that?
But, you know, because we had this discussion before. Remember at the Sanko when we were talking, discussing for the what has been called the Accord de la Saint-Sylvestre, we had that discussion. We gave them some offers saying that, okay, if you do respect the bank for them, that's what you respect the population, nothing will be out there. So we don't have here, you know, to secure somebody. If we do find out that there were mass murders, let me give you an example. Two American researchers were killed in the Kasai last year. The inquiry, I would say, it's still on. And if we found out that, you know, if the one is possible or one who gave the order for those people to get killed, what are we going to do? Are we going to tell the United States that, you know, this is the internal Congolese matter? You know, we don't want you to sue Mr. Kabila. So there are a lot of facts in here. I'm saying, and I hope that President Kabila knows why he took power, that there are some things he can do and some others he doesn't have to do. So because you are a president that you can kill people or, you know, send people to jail without, you know, them being condemned. This is also show and be, what may say, for the future, for example, for the next one president to come to say, okay, this is the way you should be. You don't have to kill people, you don't have to massacre, you don't have to put people in jail, restrain them to go out there, their liberty. You have to do the right thing according to the Constitution. So the Constitution is protecting him, and also the Constitution is going to, you know, judge him.
Abraham Lwakabwanga is a national secretary in charge of communication for the main opposition Union for Democracy and Social Progress, or UDPS. He spoke with me from the Congolese capital, Kinshasa. Barney Sirleaf, the Liberian Internal Affairs Minister, has called on Esther Walker, the superintendent for Bong County, to reinstate all chiefs she recently dismissed. Local media reports say Ms. Walker dismissed the chiefs for refusing to join the ruling party in the Bong County. But in the call for their reinstatement, the Internal Affairs Minister says the dismissal of the chiefs contradicts the standing policy of the ministry, which states that no chief should be terminated by a superintendent or any other county official without the minister's approval. For reaction, I reached Leonard Dodu, the news desk chief for the Front Page African newspaper in the Liberian capital, Monrovia.
It's been admired, because the decision to dismiss the chiefs in Bong County, though no reasons were given for that, came just a week after Vice President Joel Howard Taylor, who served as the senator for Bong County before she was elected as Vice President. She visited the county and said that those local government officials, like the chiefs, who were not members of the ruling Coalition for Democratic Change, should either join the party or they should be replaced. And then just a week afterwards, we started seeing some actions of dismissal without concrete reasons. So, I mean, it became the talk of the town. It became a major issue in the county. And people are really happy that the Ministry of Internal Affairs, which is responsible for local government, has intervened.
There are concerns that these ministers or senior officials in the government have yet to declare their assets as specified in the Constitution. Why is this going on, and has the government given reasons why the government officials are yet to declare their assets as the law in Liberia demands?
To the best of my knowledge, none of them, not even the president, has declared his assets. None of them have declared their assets. And There is no reason for that. It's just been delinquent. It's just being non-law abiding, and there's no justification for this. They had initially argued that the law says they are to declare their assets no later than the 10th of June. Now, the 10th of June has passed, and they haven't declared their assets yet. But let me put that aside. When they came up with that date, the Liberia Anti-Corruption Commission, which is responsible to receive the asset declaration, came out with a statement saying that that law has been misinterpreted and that officials who are elected or appointed to public positions are to declare their assets no later than 30 days after they've been elected or appointed. And then they still remain adamant in adhering to the Liberia Anti-Corruption Commission. The commission even went as far as saying that, okay, maybe these public officials do not understand what the process is like and why they should declare assets. So we will conduct trainings in various ministries. I cannot say confidently whether those trainings went on, but what the underlying factor here is that Liberia Anti-Corruption Commission made some efforts to make them aware that they are supposed to declare their assets. Now, they haven't declared their assets. We have information that some of them who are just entering to government have started acquiring new properties in the absence of declaring their assets. It's a major issue. We in the media have written about it. We've spoken about it. It has been discussed. But the government remains completely adamant on this issue.
How are Liberians reacting to this? Because a few of them that I understand spoke with the media are displeased about that, and they said the fight against corruption could be hampered if these government officials refuse to abide by the laws of the country which calls on them to declare their assets.
Indeed, the fight against corruption is being hampered by their non-compliance posture. Liberians in general are not really happy with this. Liberians do not understand why. I mean, they haven't declared their assets yet. But unfortunately for the government, if I should say, is that they enjoy the confidence of the majority, the vast majority. And we have a society that believes so much in the president. And, I mean, he was voted overwhelmingly. So most of his actions now are not being seen as, you know, gross error or a violation of the Constitution. Some say that it's still too early to judge him, so they want to give him some time. But the issue of asset declaration is a constitutional issue. It has a time frame attached to it. There are other laws supporting it, and then it is being blatantly ignored.
Leonard Dodu is the news desk chief for the Front Page Africa newspaper. He spoke with me from Monrovia. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has intensified his war on graft by announcing that all public servants will undergo a compulsory lifestyle audit to account for their sources of wealth. This latest announcement follows financial scandals that have rocked the country with revelations that millions of dollars were lost in various government agencies through corrupt deals that involved government officials. For VOA, Rael Ombo reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Kenyatta offered himself to be the first leader to undergo the audit that seeks to identify corrupt public officials, saying the lifestyle audits will control the misuse of public funds. He said public servants would be required to explain their sources of wealth with an aim of weeding out those found to have plundered government funds.
Ndiyo wewe tunakuona, haya basi, hii nyumba, pesa, hii mshahara, ndiyo hii ulinunua namna gani.
Speaking in Swahili, he said, "You have to tell us, this is the house you have, this is your salary, how are you able to afford it? This car that you bought, don't try to put it under your wife's name or son's name, we will still know it is yours. Where did you get it? You must explain, and I will be the first person to undergo the lifestyle audit." In the past month, various corruption scandals involving tenders and suppliers in government agencies have been unearthed. The corruption scandals, as revealed, have exposed the theft of hundreds of millions of shillings by state officials from several government bodies. So far, more than 40 government officials, including business people, have been arrested over the recent scandals. Kenyatta has continued to express his frustration over the graft that seems to have spiraled out of control since he came into office in 2013.
Mambo ya watu kuiba mali ya Wakenya, haki ya Mungu.
He said, "This issue of people stealing what belongs to Kenyans, I swear to God, it has to come to an end in Kenya." The president said the lifestyle audit will be key among other measures also put in place by the government to curb the vice. Earlier in the week, Kenyatta issued an executive order requiring all government entities and public-owned institutions to publish full details of tenders and awards from July 1, 2018.
Ya kwamba, kama ni hii barabara ambayo inajengwa hii, tender ilishindwa na nani?
He said, for example, if this road is being built, we want to know who won the tender for the construction, how much was the tender, who came in second and third, why was the first person awarded instead of these two? All these reasons we need to know. Kenyans need to know so that it is out there that this company was awarded, this tender belongs to a certain person. These are the directors. These are the shareholders. There will be no more hiding. On June 1st, President Kenyatta ordered that all heads of procurement and accounting units be vetted again. He said the vetting would include subjecting the officers to polygraph tests to determine integrity. Kenya scored 28 points out of 100 on the 2017 Corruption Perceptions Index, reported by Transparency International. The corruption index in Kenya averaged 22.62 points from 1996 until 2017. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Suicide is a global problem. 75% of suicides occur in low- and middle-income countries, according to the World Health Organization. The WHO also says suicide is the second leading cause of death among 15 to 29-year-olds worldwide. It is also a major public health issue in the United States, as we hear from VOA's health reporter Carol Pearson.
We know that suicide is preventable. It's a public health problem. It requires a public health approach.
That's Deborah Stone, lead author of a report on suicide from the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The report shows a 25% rise in suicides since 1999.
We've been tracking suicide rates for a long time, and so we've been seeing these rates going up, and it's really unfortunate and a troubling situation, but it wasn't surprising.
Stone says there are a lot of risk factors. A loss of a loved one or problems in a close relationship, being bullied, money problems, losing housing, being too isolated. But, she says, 54% of Americans who committed suicide had no known mental illness, a fact disputed by psychiatrists and other mental health experts. Dr. Bashkin Kadriou at the National Institute of Mental Health says when suicide cases are examined, more than 90% of the time, there's an undiagnosed mental illness. It's also known that trauma can cause mental health disturbances.
People who go through acute crisis and they have a lack of problem-solving ability, they are very prone to suicide.
Paul Gianfrido, head of the advocacy group Mental Health America, says the time period in the CDC report includes the 9/11 attacks when planes were used as bombs to smash into buildings in New York and into the Pentagon in Washington.
And because so many people have been exposed to trauma locally and so many people, young people, have gone off to fight endless wars and come back with traumatic stress and other conditions affecting them, it would have been predictable that our suicide rate would have been increasing over this time.
All agree that suicide can be prevented and solutions can be found. Gianfrido says mental health issues have to be addressed early on and that everyone should be screened for mental health issues annually.
There's a big gap between the need that's out there and our ability to have identified them and do something about it.
Kadriou says just as many factors lead to suicide, there have to be multiple solutions, including solving the opioid crisis and finding a way to keep guns out of the hands of people at risk. Stone says proven methods to reduce suicides, like more community involvement, need to be put in place because the research shows the problem is getting worse.
What is really needed is suicide prevention and wide implementation of comprehensive suicide prevention that includes things that can help individuals being who are at risk, and it also includes things for people who aren't at risk, so we can prevent the risk factors that lead to suicidal thinking in the first place.
Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Joner, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hello, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In highlights from the World Cup, Iran won their first match at a World Cup finals since 1998, as Morocco substitute Aziz Bahadouz scored an own goal in injury time. Bahadouz put the ball into his own net with a diving header at the near post in the 95th minute as Morocco defended a left-wing free kick. The result was harsh on the African side, who had wasted numerous chances in the first half and were denied late on when Iran goalkeeper Alireza produced a fine save from Hakim Ziyech. But Iran took the victory, only their second in World Cup history, after a 2-1 win over the US at France 1998. Morocco became the second African side to concede a late winning goal in the World Cup on Friday after Egypt lost 1-0 to Uruguay. Morocco is in the same group as 2010 winners Spain and European champions Portugal, with only the top two sides advancing to the last 16. Spain and Portugal, 10th and 4th in the world rankings respectively, have won four major tournaments between them in the past 10 years, and they settled for a 3-3 draw on Friday. On Saturday, Lionel Messi's bid to win the World Cup got off to a nightmare start as he missed a penalty, and his Argentinian side were surprisingly held 1-1 by debutants Iceland. France beat Australia 2-1. In the opening match on Thursday, World Cup host Russia made easy work of Saudi Arabia with a 5-0 thrashing. Meanwhile, Mohamed Salah is fit for Egypt's World Cup group match with Russia on Tuesday, according to the Egyptian Football Association. The 25-year-old Salah was an unused substitute in his country's 1-0 defeat by Uruguay in the opening group game on Thursday, when he was also declared fit. He injured his shoulder playing for Liverpool in the Champions League final on May 26th. And the former Ghanaian Football Association GFA president, Kwesi Nyantakyi, has resigned from the posts he held with FIFA and the Confederation of African Football, CAF. It is his latest move after a film was released last week in which he was seen apparently accepting a gift of $65,000 shopping money from an undercover reporter. He denies any wrongdoing, but World Football governing body FIFA suspended Nyantakyi for 90 days on June 8th, but he has now left his role on the FIFA Council. He has also stepped aside from his roles with CAF, including as first vice president, the most senior figure at the Confederation after its president, Ahmad. And Nigeria beat the Gambia 6-0 in Lagos on Monday to qualify for the 2018 Women's Africa Cup of Nations in Ghana. The Super Falcons, who are the defending African champions, will play alongside South Africa, Cameroon, Equatorial Guinea, Zambia, Algeria, and Mali at this year's finals, along with the host Ghana. With a slender 1-0 lead from the first leg in Banjul, Nigeria made sure of their place with an emphatic victory to win 7-0 on aggregate. On Sunday, South Africa overwhelmed Lesotho 6-0 to book their place with a 7-0 aggregate win. Algeria also went through to the finals in Ghana with a big aggregate, thanks to a 3-2 victory away to Ethiopia. In other qualifiers, Mali were held to a goalless draw at home by Ivory Coast, but it was enough for Mali to progress on away goals after the first leg had ended 2-2. Zimbabwe, who won their away leg 1-0, suffered heartbreak at home to Zambia to go out on the away goals rule. With 3 minutes remaining in Harare, it was 1-1 until a late strike from Barbara Banda, which gave Zambia a 2-1 victory on the day and 2-2 overall and the place at the finals. Cameroon looked impressive with another big victory over Congo-Brazzaville in Yaoundé on Saturday. Having won the first leg 5-0, Cameroon produced another 5-0 thrashing to go through 10-0 on aggregate. Equatorial Guinea also qualified on Saturday, overturning a 2-1 first leg deficit against Kenya to win 2-0 in Bata and win the tie 3-2. And that's it for this edition of Netland Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
Yeah.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. In discussions preceding the recently concluded summit meeting between President Donald Trump and President Kim Jong-un, speculations were made as to who is most deserving of the Nobel Peace Prize. No one mentioned the new Prime Minister of Ethiopia, Abiy Ahmed, for what he has been doing since he was appointed in April this year. But it's important that we take note of what the Prime Minister has been undertaking since his appointment. In the first place, one must recognize that this is a man who has specialized in peace study and mediation. Also, the ruling party of Ethiopia did itself a good service when it selected someone from Oromo ethnic group to be the Prime Minister of Ethiopia. As is well known, the people of Oromia have been arguing that they are in the majority and that they deserve a leading role in the governance of the country. So they did select Ahmed, a Muslim, and someone from Oromia. But he has also been in pushing the reconstruction and reconciliation in Ethiopia when the decision was made to release so many prisoners and then to try to heal the division within Ethiopia itself. And recently, he made a significant move to end the rift between Ethiopia and Eritrea. When these two sides defeated the Derg, the leaders of Eritrea and Ethiopia worked together and they were cooperating until the terrible war over Badme. And it was regrettable that when the Boundary Commission gave Badme to Eritrea, the previous government of Ethiopia did not comply with the decision and nothing was done. Now, Prime Minister Ahmed has said that Ethiopia will accept the ruling of the Boundary Committee and will implement it. Regrettably, we have not yet had any definitive statement from President Isaias Afwerki of Eritrea as to what is the position of Eritrea to this demarche of President Ahmed. But Prime Minister Ahmed also has moved in another direction. There has been some conflict or disagreement between Egypt and Ethiopia over the Renaissance Dam, which Egypt has complained will take more water from the Nile River, which is vital to the survival of Egypt. And now Prime Minister Ahmed has reached out to President Sisi and assured him that Egypt will not lose a single ounce of water because of the Renaissance Dam. There also seems to be a move, not certain, but it may be the influence of Prime Minister Ahmed in the new change in IGAD's position regarding the dispute in South Sudan. It was recently announced that IGAD has changed its position and now wants the leader of the rebel movement or opposition group in South Sudan, Riek Machar, who was disclosed to have been detained in South Africa at the request of IGAD. And now IGAD is calling for a meeting between President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar in Addis Ababa. And this has been followed by a specific invitation from Prime Minister Ahmed to both men to meet in Addis Ababa to reconcile the differences. This is the kind of progressive liberal leaders that Africa needs. And it is important that recognition be given to this move by the Prime Minister of Ethiopia. Africa deserves leaders like Prime Minister Ahmed of Ethiopia. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoyed the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, Nick Ivanov, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the lizard that lives high up in the Iroko tree does not hear the roar of the lion. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The world is getting smaller and more complicated, and it poses a growing number of national security and foreign policy challenges for the United States and its allies and partners. U.S. security assistance programs are a crucial foreign policy tool to address such challenges. They promote long-term relationships, enhance regional security and interoperability with U.S. forces, and strengthen the professionalism of the armed forces of allied and partner nations. The International Military Education and Training Program, or IMET, is one such program, which is overseen by the Department's Bureau of Political Military Affairs and executed by the Department of Defense. IMET funds the attendance of foreign military and select civilian personnel at U.S. military professional education and training courses offered by Department of Defense institutions of higher learning across the United States. IMET training also serves as a cultural exchange program by introducing students to key elements of U.S. democracy, such as civilian control of the military, separation of powers and legislative oversight, and exposing them to U.S. values like free speech, freedom of the press, and commitment to human rights and international law. Finally, IMET fosters the development of important professional and personal relationships between U.S. officers and mid- to senior-level officers in partner militaries, many of whom go on to fill senior leadership positions in their militaries and governments. Since 1976, IMET has significantly enhanced the security of both the United States and its partners and created decades-long friendships between course participants. It is another great example of how small but smart investments in global security pay large dividends over time.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.